paying the price of the war on terror.
If you count the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, and the broader global war on terror, plus the growth of counterterrorism programs in the United States and creation of new agencies like the Department of Homeland Security, I think it's probably one of the largest transfers of wealth in American history.
That's journalist James Risen. We talk with him about his explosive new book, Pay Any Price: Greed, Power, and Endless War. Then climate talks are happening again. Is the political will there yet to push for real solutions?
Climate change has this weird capacity that people can be very concerned about it when they think about it, but not be able to bring it to mind when they're asked what they're concerned about.
That's George Marshall. He tells us what's been keeping the climate crisis from seizing the hearts and minds of the public, and how to change that. His important book is Don't Even Think About It. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The shocking revelations from the U.S. Senate report on CIA torture starkly revealed just how far our country has fallen in moral standing since we began the war on terror. It's but one part of the terrible price we've paid in blood, treasure, and our national soul as a result of U.S. government policy in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. My guest, acclaimed journalist James Risen, has been bringing the story of government overreach in the national security sphere to light as investigative reporter for the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer in 2006, along with colleague Eric Lichtblau, for their reports on NSA surveillance programs, work that's made him a target for possible legal action by the Obama administration to force him to reveal his confidential sources. Risen's new book, Pay Any Price, reveals the shocking corruption, waste, and abuse of our metastasizing homeland security industrial complex. One salient example, which Risen discusses in his book, is the $81 million we paid to a pair of private contractor psychologists to advise a CIA torture program, a program we now know revealed nothing of value to the safety of Americans, but led our government to commit serious war crimes. From the bankrupting of the American taxpayer to the moral bankruptcy of the state, Risen's powerful book delineates in detail the price we are all paying for the war on terror. So, James Risen, welcome to Writer's Voice. Your book, Pay Any Price, lays out the various prices that we are paying in blood and treasure. Let's start with treasure. The cost is $4 trillion and counting. Can you help us make some sense of that figure and how it has been arrived at?
That's the best estimate I've been able to find for the total cost of the war on terror. If you count the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, and the broader global war on terror, plus the growth of counterterrorism programs in the United States and creation of new agencies like the Department of Homeland Security, it's an estimate, but it shows the massive scale of what we have done since 9/11. And I think it's probably one of the largest transfers of wealth in American history. And hardly anybody's really talking about it.
Transfers of wealth?
Well, a lot of the money has gone to contractors or to create new jobs in the federal government, in the intelligence community, or in counterterrorism. And it's money from American taxpayers that's gone to create a new national security apparatus that didn't really exist on the same scale before, both contractors and government agencies. And so it's really helped turn Washington into a much richer town than it was before. I think one of the statistics I point out is that, forget the exact numbers, but most of the richest counties in the United States now are in the Washington area. And I think it's kind of ironic that especially so many people are always worried about deficit spending and on domestic spending and other things, but they never look at the dramatic increases in counterterrorism and national security spending, which has far outstripped all other the growth of any other programs.
And you ascribe that to the intersection of greed and power that's dependent on continuing the war on terror. You call it the Homeland Security industrial complex. Talk more about that term. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, basically, if you remember after 9/11, Dick Cheney said, you know, the gloves come off. And what he really meant by that was that we were deregulating national security. And at the same time, we were pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into counterterrorism and national security. And so you had this whole new apparatus that with few regulations and little oversight, with massive new spending. And the government, you know, the people at the FBI, the CIA, the Pentagon, had more money than they really knew what to do with. And so they started spending it on contractors who claimed that they had the secret to finding Osama bin Laden or solving the next terrorist attack or whatever. So it became like a gold rush, it was kind of like Washington's version of the internet bubble.
One of those guys who came right in was Dennis Montgomery, a con artist who you call a perfect case study of what you're talking about. Who was he?
Dennis Montgomery was a computer software expert, so self-styled expert, who in 2003, he was able to convince the CIA that he had super secret software that could identify hidden numbers and letters that were hidden in Al Jazeera news broadcasts. And the CIA became convinced that these were Al-Qaeda codes that were being sent to Al-Qaeda sleeper agents around the world to attack airplanes. And they became so convinced of this that at Christmas time in 2003, they got President Bush to ground flights all over the world that were coming to the United States based on Montgomery's numbers and letters, which they believed corresponded with flights that were scheduled to come to the U.S. And only later did they realize this was all a hoax and a fabrication. And after they realized that, the CIA covered the whole thing up and never talked about it.
And how much did he manage to make off with?
Well, he had contracts with several different agencies at the military and throughout the government. And so he was making millions of dollars from the U.S. government, and he continued to get more contracts after this. That's one of the most amazing things. He was getting contracts into the start of the Obama administration.
You cite one study that says that government spending on Homeland Security has been so excessive that the only way it could be considered cost effective would be if it had prevented 1,667 terrorist attacks each year.
I love that. I mean, that's I thought that statistic gives you a real barometer for, you know, people love cost benefit analysis, at least they say they do, but that's one. If you could stop 4 terrorist attacks a day, then the amount of money we've been spending would make sense. But it's just a way of saying what we've done is so far in excess of the actual threat that we face as a nation, that it's just, we've just given in to scaring ourselves to death with hyperbole and panic.
A kind of war on terror that's been practiced on us.
Yeah, we've terrorized ourselves. I mean, I quote Brian Jenkins, who is a really thoughtful terrorism analyst at the RAND Corporation. And he said, I love this statistic. He said that nobody would believe this, but the decade since 9/11 has actually been the safest in the United States. We've had the fewest terrorist attacks in the United States since 9/11 than we've had in any decade since the 1950s.
Wow.
And nobody wants to think about that, but because they all forget the bombings and the attacks from either right-wing or left-wing groups back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And yet we act as if terrorism is some new existential threat to the United States.
Well, I guess some people would say that the reason we haven't had any more terrorist attacks is because we've been spending all this money.
Yeah, that would be the argument of the government, and it would be the argument used by the defenders of the war on terror. And it's one reason why we haven't had more of a debate, is because we have allowed ourselves to believe that perfect security is the answer, and it's the only thing politicians are willing to accept. And so there's no real debate, because people say, well, I don't want to look soft on terrorism. I've got to agree to spend everything all the time and agree to every new program. Otherwise, someone is going to say I was soft on terrorism. And that's the political dynamic in this country today. And it makes it impossible to have any real debate on these issues. We're kind of frozen as a society on the kind of debate we can have.
Well, let's talk about where some of the money has gone and is going. And starting back, I remember, you know, in 2003, and so I remember beginning to hear after Paul Bremer took over as proconsul, I guess, of Iraq, boatloads of cash coming in. You actually tell us where that cash was stored and what happened. You said there was a thievery on an industrial scale. Tell us the story of the East Rutherford Operations Center and what happened there.
Yes, it's an amazing story. And the United States and the Coalition Provisional Authority airlifted $12 to $14 billion in cash in $100 bills. They took it out of the East Rutherford, New Jersey currency facility of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. They drove it to Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington. It was loaded onto Air Force C-17s, and then airlifted to Baghdad International Airport, and then convoyed from the airport to the Green Zone or to the Iraqi Central Bank. And after that, a lot of it went missing and disappeared. The money was from the Development Fund for Iraq, which was a Iraqi government account at the Fed that had been set up right after the invasion to hold oil revenues of the Iraqi government. So it was Iraqi money, not U.S. taxpayer money, but still it was being in the custody of U.S. officials and of the CPA. It went missing, and then at various times the Special Inspector General for Iraq, Stuart Bowen, investigated and kept finding that billions of it was unaccounted for or missing. He at one point stated that I think almost $12 billion of the $20 billion in cash and funds that was sent were unaccounted for. Because in addition to the $12 to $14 billion in cash, there was another $5 or $6 billion sent by electronic funds transfers. Finally, he and his investigators tracked down nearly $2 billion to a bunker in rural Lebanon, where it had been stolen from Baghdad and then moved to Lebanon by the people who stole it. And it's probably one of the largest robberies in modern history, at least one of the largest that people know about.
So how did this happen? I mean, you know, theoretically, this was under the purview of the U.S., Who took it?
It's unclear exactly who. It's believed to be some powerful Iraqis who as yet remain unidentified. Bowen tried to get the CIA and the FBI involved in an investigation, and neither one wanted to get involved. He also met with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, and Maliki asked him questions about it and expressed anger at the way the U.S. had handled the money, but the Iraqi government never conducted an investigation. And I think the truth is that nobody really wants to find out the answers, because the answers would probably be very awkward and inconvenient.
Well, what do you think this says about this security industrial complex and how it's been created? What are the systemic reasons that underlie the ability of this kind of theft on a grand scale to happen?
Well, there's been very little oversight, very little regulation. And it goes back to, I think, to that basic premise of the way the war on terror started was the gloves come off, do whatever you think is necessary. Don't worry about the rules. Don't worry about oversight. And I think that was the climate. People just have been conducting operations without any worry that someone is going to call them into account. I think it goes back to that issue you said earlier, you know, wouldn't some people think that they don't care how much money is spent or how many lives are lost, as long as there's not a terrorist attack in the United States.
Right. And yet you always hear when it comes to schools, we shouldn't be throwing money at schools to make them better.
Right. Right. And so this, we have a fetish for perfect security on this issue. And it's, I think it's, it leads you to a lot of unintended consequences.
And those are the consequences that you talk about in your book, James Risen, in Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. You write about KBR. I mean, one of the prices, many of the cost, is paid in blood, not just Iraqi civilians, although that's a huge amount and very underreported, but also, of course, our own soldiers who we've sent over there. Just before Armistice Day, a paralyzed Iraq war vet turned peace activist, Thomas Young, died. He was quite eloquent about the cost in blood. You write about it as well. One of the things you talk about is something that I had not heard at all about, and I follow these issues pretty closely, and that is the role of KBR, Halliburton's, you know, they used to be under Halliburton, which was connected to Dick Cheney. The issue of lung damage on a massive epidemic scale, connect the dots.
Well, KBR was the largest defense contractor in the war zone in Iraq. They provided all the basic services for the U.S. military, food, housing, water, and many other basic services that the military used to perform for itself, but now has outsourced all those things. And so KBR, throughout the war in Iraq, made about $39 billion in contracts in Iraq. One of the contracts they had was for waste disposal at U.S. bases in Iraq. And they, what they were supposed to be doing was providing environmentally sound waste disposal. What they did ultimately, though, was build burn pits. They just dug huge pits right outside many of the major military bases in Iraq and dumped everything, all kinds of waste, you know, from, you know, large parts to human, you know, to trash, to all kinds of waste that you could imagine. And then they would pour jet fuel on it and burn it. And these big pits, burn pits, would burn all day. And they would leave huge clouds of smoke over the bases. And a lot of U.S. personnel would come back from Iraq complaining about various lung or breathing disorders. So there began to be kind of a syndrome of lung disorders that doctors were beginning to see in the United States. And a number of veterans who have been injured with this lung injury have sued KBR over the way in which they handled these burn pits. And KBR has fought back, and these lawsuits have gone back and forth. And what I describe in the book is how one epidemiologist at the Veterans Administration, who was doing surveys of veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, began to see a lot of correlation between people, veterans who said that they had served in Iraq and veterans who said they had breathing or developed breathing or lung problems. And he felt that the Veterans Administration, his bosses there, didn't want to hear that kind of information because it would raise all kinds of questions. So it's really interesting how much, you know, it to me, it's kind of like the Agent Orange issue of Vietnam. And it's one thing that I think we're going to continue to hear more about as veterans get older and, you know, more of these kind of illnesses develop.
In Vietnam, with Agent Orange, you didn't have the huge proportion of contractors, of private contractors. You didn't have KBR. It was a U.S. Army that was using Agent Orange, and eventually there were able to be hearings, and the issue came out. What is the impact of having so much of this war on terror being fought by private contractors for veterans to get redress and for these kinds of things to be investigated and come to light?
Well, a lot of veterans or their families for various issues have to go to court, to U.S. court, to try and sue these companies. KBR, for instance, a woman named Cheryl Harris, who I describe in the book, her son was a Green Beret in Iraq who was electrocuted in his shower in his quarters in Baghdad. And an investigation showed that there was faulty wiring, and KBR was responsible for handling the wiring in that building. And she has sued KBR for, in relationship to her son's death. And that case, I think, is still pending and still before the Supreme Court.
So let's move on a little bit to Obama, because you've actually said that Obama has made this national security state permanent. How has he done that? How has he both continued what was begun under the previous administration and changed it or promoted it?
Well, I think, you know, basically he has continued and extended the Bush administration war on terror almost intact. The only real change he's made is on torture. He stopped the enhanced interrogation program, which actually had already been stopped under Bush, but he issued new rules to prevent it from being reinstated. And so apart from that, he continued the war in Afghanistan, in fact, escalated troop levels there. He continued the war in Iraq until the deadline set by Bush originally for troop withdrawals. He has kept Guantanamo open after saying he was going to close it. He has expanded the use of drones and had more drone strikes than Bush ever did. And he's allowed the NSA's domestic surveillance program to grow far beyond anything that Bush originally contemplated. And so I think that shows that there is much more continuity than anything else. I think it's partly because he felt like he wanted to focus on domestic policy at the beginning of his administration, and so didn't want to have a fight with Republicans on national security. I also think he was probably more conservative on these issues than people realized when he was elected.
But so much of what you talk about in Pay Any Price, James Risen, is this whole industrial complex. In other words, that it's about greed and, you know, the manipulation of fear in order to support these huge this huge transfer of wealth without very much oversight, as you've said here. Has Obama increased oversight? Has at least any of this money, is this being used more responsibly?
No. In fact, I think one of the legacies of Obama has been to invoke more secrecy and impose more secrecy on this than ever existed before. He's used state secret privilege on many lawsuits brought by people trying to find out information about these programs and crack down on whistleblowers who try to talk about it. And so, in fact, he has invoked a, you know, kind of a cloud of secrecy around this that is more intense than even Bush had.
And you say that secrecy actually breeds corruption.
Yeah, if nobody knows what you're doing, it's easy to get away with things. I mean, that's just human nature. It's transparency, it's openness that forces people to behave. That's just, you know, it's like your kids. If you don't watch your kids and don't know what they're doing, they're going to get into trouble. And the same thing with the national security state. It's no different from your kids.
And of course, we all know that you have been caught up in this whole issue over transparency and secrecy, because you did bring things to light in your last book, State of War. I mean, the New York Times actually sat on some important revelations that you had that might have changed the outcome of the 2004 election, although we can never practice counterfactual history here.
Right.
What has been the impact on you of this battle?
Well, you know, I've kind of gotten used to it. My wife and kids have been very supportive, and so that makes a huge difference. And my wife is a former journalist, and so she understands all of these things and has been very supportive. So, I'm just kind of learned to live with it and learned to accept the fact that, you know, something may happen, but I don't know what it will be, and I'm just going to keep going. And basically, my real answer to the government was to write this new book and to say that, you know, I'm not going to stop reporting.
And have you seen an impact on your fellow journalists?
From my case?
Yeah, from the prosecution. Well, you haven't been prosecuted, but they're going to haul you into court and try to get you to reveal your sources, and you're going to refuse.
Well, I think what I'm trying to do now, I feel an obligation to kind of represent journalists in this. And so I'm trying to uphold the traditions of the profession. And I'm only doing, I think, what I believe almost any other journalist would do. I don't think I'm doing anything more courageous or different from most of the reporters I know. I think they would all do the same thing in my position. So I'm just trying to represent the profession.
We're talking with James Risen about his new book, Pay Any Price: Greed, Power, and Endless War. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Now, in the last section of the book, you have three chapters: the war on decency, the war on normalcy, and the war on truth. Let's start with a war on decency, the moral price that we've paid, from Abu Ghraib to civilian deaths from drones. You go deeply into something called the SEER program. Talk about the SEER program.
SEER program was the survival program created by the military for pilots and other other personnel who might be captured, to give them a simulated training in what it would be like to be subjected to interrogations if they were prisoners of war. That program was started, really, I guess, after the Korean War or after the Vietnam War, when because so many Americans were brutally treated by the Koreans and the Vietnamese in captivity. And the idea of the program was to help them learn to cope. And what happened after 9/11 was that the CIA, along with some contractors, reverse engineered that program and used that as the basis for their enhanced interrogation program of Al-Qaeda detainees. And what many people now believe, it was a totally misuse of the program, because the SEER techniques, interrogation techniques, were never designed to elicit accurate information. They were designed to show American military personnel what would happen to you if you underwent brutal treatment by an adversary. And it was designed to show how you break people. And so it was a misuse of that program. What I show in the book is that the experts, the academic experts on that program, who had studied how U.S. military personnel responded to the SEER interrogation techniques, their research showed that it did not provide accurate information, and it led to short-term memory loss because of the trauma, and so could not have been used to gather accurate information, and that research was ignored by the CIA.
They actually claimed that Abu Zubaydah, you know, they said that under torture he revealed important information, but you track that one down. What did you find out?
Well, I think the Senate, it's one of the points that the Senate and the intelligence report gets into in great detail, I believe. It's already been reported that they have shown that the program didn't work and that the information that supposedly they got from detainees who the government has, some people in the government have tried to argue led to Osama bin Laden, did not lead to bin Laden, and that the torture never provided significant information.
Contrary to the movies.
Yes.
It actually didn't work. But it did have an impact. You tell the story of Damien Corsetti, and here is, you know, one of the prices that we pay, the price we pay in blood, in disorder. In fact, there is now a new term going around the military called moral injury. Tell us about Damien Corsetti. He's really an example of this.
Yeah, Damien Corsetti was an enlisted Army interrogator. He enlisted in the Army and then was made into an interrogator at Bagram in Afghanistan, and then at Abu Ghraib in Iraq. And he came home with severe PTSD from his years of interrogation, and also from the fact that after he returned home, he was put on trial for the harsh interrogations he was involved with at Bagram. And so he is, I profile his life, which is a very sad story, I think, about how he has tried to cope today, or since his return home, with the trauma, the post-traumatic stress trauma that he is enduring now from having been an interrogator. And he told me that just about everybody in his unit who were involved in interrogations came home with some form of PTSD. And so it shows that, you know, the brutalization of prisoners also brutalizes the Army who does it.
So things were bad enough when you first came out with this book. It hasn't been that long. But since its publication, there's been the midterm elections. Looking into your crystal ball, what do you think will happen with the trends that you point out in your book?
I think that's an interesting question, because the Republican Party has been in the midst of a transformation or transition on these issues traditionally Republicans have been very supportive of the war on terror, but then you have some more of a libertarian wing of the party that's been growing with people like Rand Paul, who have been questioning the war on terror and the attack on our civil liberties. And so it'll be an interesting fight within the Republican Party over which side of which wing of the party takes control on these issues. And so it'll be interesting to watch.
It will indeed. And your book, it was just a really fascinating read. Pay Any Price. Thank you so much, James Risen.
Thank you.
In addition to Pay Any Price, James Risen has written three other books, including State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Pay Any Price. Next up, George Marshall tells us why we don't want to think about global warming and how to change that. Stay tuned after the break.
You who are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. 400,000 people marched to save the climate in September and then watched as climate-denying politicians were overwhelmingly elected to the U.S. Congress. Why, with the stakes so dire for our survival, is the political will to press for real solutions on the climate so lacking? Why, despite overwhelming scientific evidence, do we still ignore climate change? It's a question that my guest George Marshall seeks to answer in his terrific new book, Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change. He argues the problem is in the stories we tell, or don't tell, and he calls for a new frame on climate change that breaks out of the environmental sphere to touch every aspect of our lives. Marshall is the founder of the Climate Outreach Information Network and writes the blog climatedenial.org. Well, George Marshall, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
A lot of people write about, you know, why aren't we doing more about climate change from an institutional standpoint? But your purpose is different. You look at the psychological reasons. Why is that?
Yes, of course there's something which is going on with the structure of society, of the structure of the economy. And of course there's issues of power. And of course there is a misinformation campaign which is politically motivated. We know all of that. But for me, that just didn't adequately explain why decent, honorable people, people who are normally very alert to things right across the political range, just didn't seem to get this. I also think that there are good explanations in this for why it becomes so politically polarized too. But I think in particular why also it's not talked about. The vast majority of people don't talk about it at all. And I think that's what led me also into the psychology of it. Really a very simple thing actually, which is the sort of the starting point almost for the book, is trying to ask why it is that the majority of people, even here in America, will say that climate change is a concern to them or a worry if they're asked about it. But if they're asked what is a worry for them, they don't mention climate change. Now, that's very unusual. Climate change has this weird capacity that people can be very concerned about it when they think about it, but not be able to bring it to mind when they're asked what they're concerned about.
You talk about there's two ways that the brain has of assimilating information. One is rational, the other is emotional. Tell us, why can we get so caught in the thickets that we can't really get climate change?
amongst all the issues we deal with, climate change is particularly driven by information and data. I mean, we have to take a great deal of it on trust from scientists and make sense of it. I think other issues are much more clear and evident, and we can see them with more certainty. And this is a problem for us because we weigh up these kinds of information in different ways, and the brain has different processing systems for different kinds of information. So the rather abstract symbols, graphs, mathematical-based information behind climate change is processed in a different way from things which are concerned with immediate threat. Therefore, we tend to put it on one side. We like to think that we're very rational. We like to think that, you know, that we weigh things up in a balanced way. But there's a very large body of psychological research now to show that actually that's not the case. And we give an overwhelming precedence to things that push our emotional buttons. So, of course, seeing video of American or British citizens being beheaded after being kidnapped by terrorists presses every single one of our buttons in a very, very powerful way. A piece of research that suggests that on current trajectory, 2/3 of food production across the Midwest or across sub-Saharan Africa could disappear, and with enormous suffering for people as a result of climate change. That sounds awful, but we're not seeing the pictures, we're not seeing the images, and we're not seeing the enemies. So we work in this very basic way. And all of the cognitive psychologists I spoke to said the same thing over and over again. They said that we have to find a way of converting the abstract information-based material of climate change into something which speaks to that emotional side. And in the book, I argue that because we have to convert it in this way, it becomes very, very heavily laden with the values and the politics of the people who tell the story. It ends up only really existing and mobilizing us in the form of the stories we tell about it. And then because those stories are so based in who we are and the way that we speak, we then react to them in terms of the values that they carry. For me, this is the primary reason why people of conservative politics do not accept climate change, is they simply do not accept the way that the story about climate change has been told by people of more liberal and environmental politics.
And what is that story that they don't accept?
I think there's two aspects to that. I think it's what it contains and what it doesn't contain. The first thing to say is that climate change, in my view, should never have been an environmental issue. And that sounds a bit strange because everyone goes, well, of course it's environmental. But actually, it isn't really. It crosses all boundaries. As I just said, it can destroy food production. So it's an agricultural issue. It's a territorial issue. It's a water supply issue. It's a resource issue. It's a fossil fuel issue. It's a human rights issue. It's a religious and faith issue. It's anything at all you want it to be.
It's a moral issue as well.
We can keep adding to that. By any criteria of what concerns us, there is no reason to think that climate change could not be primarily defined in terms of that. So the fact that we have decided or that it has become defined as being environmental over and above all of those other meanings and readings is a huge limitation on it. I often like to think, what would climate change look like if, for example, there wasn't an environmental movement, but there was a very strong and powerful human rights movement? Because it is a huge human rights issue. As you say, it's a moral issue, and it's going to be the leading motor of future conflict. In fact, Red Cross says it already is. What would it look like? And the answer is, it would look completely different. The way we think and talk about it would be different, all the images would be different, and language would be different. And it would speak to people in a very different way. So environmentalists, and I count myself, I'm proud to be a member of the environmental movement, took hold of this issue when it first emerged in the 70s and then through into the 80s, and it seemed to be concerned with pollution and from industrial processes. It was associated with the way that we lived, and the solutions to it involved things which environmentalists like, things like using less stuff, using less oil and gas, doing things locally, maybe eating less meat. I mean, there's a lot of things there that environmentalists like. So it chimed very strongly. And of course, then what we did as environmentalists was we made it totally our own. We started using our own language and words around it. We started talking about, like, stop this or defend this or action on this. As a typical example of that is that we put our images all over it. So it became, the polar bear became the icon of climate change, and still is. In any media article, there's a polar bear there. If you go out and ask people in the street what they associate with climate change, they'll say polar bear and penguins. Why? Well, because that's what environmentalists put there. In many ways, it's a lousy symbol. It really should never have been one. I mean, why on earth have an image of something associated with cold in order to communicate something to do with hot? You know, like I said in the book, like, you know, they don't. There's a reason why in advertising, penguins are used for selling, you know, fridges and freezers and not selling ovens. And especially because it seems a very, very long way away. It's something outside people's lives far away. So people go, oh, that's terrible. Yeah, let's save the polar bear. That is not what climate change is about. And, of course, no other organizations would ever have put a bear as their central icon. Because we understand climate change entirely through these images and this language, that becomes climate change. For people, climate change becomes the environmental issue about polar bears that's telling them that they can't use their car.
Yet I wonder if that story's really changing, and that it's almost as if it's going from that story where people can distance themselves from climate change to another story that is so emotionally terrifying that people don't even want to look it in the face. And you start your book, George Marshall, Don't Even Think About It, by going to a place where people have just been through probably a climate-influenced disaster, a wildfire in Texas, and they don't even want to connect the dots between what's just happened to them, the loss of their community through wildfire and a climate-caused drought, and climate change.
It certainly was a surprise to me, although actually nothing should be a surprise. I think that the reason for that is because I think that we really are in new social and psychological territory with this. We've never faced anything quite like this. And I must say, as this century unfolds, all bets are off how this pans out, because we're quite capable of reacting in very strange ways. Of course, one would assume, as all the scientists and campaigners do, that when people go through extreme weather events, that therefore they're more inclined to accept climate change. After all, we think that it's hard for people to accept climate change because it's far away and it seems very abstract. As I said, it seems quite on that rational side of a brain. But surely when your house burns down, surely that moves over strongly onto that emotional side, you would think. But of course, it doesn't quite work like that, because our experience and how we interpret it is mediated through the stories we tell. And the thing I found in where you mentioned Bastrop in Texas, a third of a town burnt down. This was a biggest fire-related disaster in Texan history. But I also went actually to New Jersey as well and spoke to survivors of Hurricane Sandy. And what was clear was that the story which had developed there in their community was one of strength and resilience and rebuilding and reinvesting and hope, lots of very positive things, which allowed no space for the anxiety-provoking and distressing thought that this might be the harbinger of a pattern to come of increased and ever more extreme weather. The last people want to hear that are people who have just invested their very last savings in rebuilding their house. And they're also feeling good about themselves. They're not feeling good about their experience, but the communities are strong. They know that some people accept climate change and some don't. They don't want to talk about it. So it feels exploitative to talk about climate change when people are recovering from the event. It just goes to show how complex this issue is and how we cannot assume anything about it and how ready we are to push it on one side and to create silence around it.
You also talk about something called confirmation bias and biased assimilation. What are those things? How do they influence how we think about climate change?
Well, these are universal human qualities. If you know, I find myself thinking about, you know, did I buy the right house? And I find myself going, well, somebody said what a great house it was. Well, it seems like it looks beautiful in the photographs. And these are all ways that it's confirming the view I want to reach, which is that I made a right decision. And so I pull on the evidence which is around me. Even when something isn't going very well, you find yourself trying to pull together the arguments which fit the thing that you want. It's a basic way that we're wired to do things. So that's what we call confirmation bias. It's a bias towards cherry-picking the evidence that confirms the position we already have. The problem with climate change, as I said, is because it's rather abstract. The information is uncertain. Was Hurricane Sandy caused by climate change? Wasn't it? How much of it was? It puts us in a very strong position if we think that climate change is happening to say, yes, it was, and if we think it was not, to say, no, it wasn't. And it's a problem for climate change that the impacts, these weather impacts, tend to come in the pattern of just simply being a lot more of something that we already have. California has a drought. California has always been dry, has always had droughts. So a record-breaking drought just seems like more of the same. And on the basis of that, you decide, is this just evidence that that weather is variable and it can sometimes be extremely dry in California, or do you see it as proof of climate change? And we can keep doing this. We can keep doing this indefinitely. This is the danger. And also, we keep taking the measure of what we look at for what constitutes change from the most recent events. So the polar vortex, for example, which came down last winter, was that extreme? Well, not so extreme in terms of long-term temperature record. It only feels extreme because winters have been getting warmer and warmer. So we're always taking our measure from the most recent events. One of the experts in the psychology of risk said to me that if climate change turned the sky purple, it would be very different. But it doesn't. It simply delivers stuff that we're actually very, very good at adapting to and coping with and rebuilding from.
Until, of course, it doesn't. Now, I want to go back to when you were talking about conservatives. I don't know, I don't remember if you mentioned the Tea Party, but you do talk about in the book the view of those who are the climate skeptics, as they call themselves, or the Tea Party, the people who swallow the propaganda that is being fed to them by the carbon combustion complex. What is the story that they see that blinds them to what's going on around them?
Well, let's first of all say that this language you're using of swallowing the information fed to them is sort of rather underplaying their own autonomy and intelligence in what they do. It's not a simple matter of there being vested interests that are developing misinformation and shoveling them into people's brains. What they're doing in the denial industry, and I'll call it that, and I met several of the people involved with that when I wrote the book and had very interesting conversations with them. These are people who I think sincerely believe what they're saying. They're politically motivated on it. What those people are doing is they're developing the information and the stories that the people want to hear. It's that confirmation bias again. People find climate change challenging. It challenges their values. And so they're very inclined to pick up on the stories and the lines which are fed to them. And I think it's a tragedy. And I'm not misusing that word. I had a great day of a Texan Tea Party. And actually, I've met a lot of conservatives around America. I have the advantage of being British, so people are very nice to me and very open to me in a way that might be harder for people who are American. I was struck actually by how motivated they were, how energetic they were, focused on their communities, how politically active, how engaged with change they were. Lots of things which in those own rights are actually very positive. And actually in some ways how similar they were to the activists I know from the liberal side who are working on climate change. These are people who are very publicly engaged people and they really should be involved. I think part of the problem, though, is that, as I say, climate change has come along in this form, which is not just inherently challenging to them, but has been helped in every way by the fact that it's labeled at every single level with values that they do not share, with liberal environmentalist values. And there's actually very few values there that speak to them. There's no narrative out there, for example, about climate change and property. There's no narrative about climate change and freedom, except the one that the deniers have pumped out there to say that the people campaigning on climate change trying to take away your freedom. But there's a very powerful argument to say that climate change threatens people's freedom in its own right and their property, and that it's something which calls on conservative values of taking personal responsibility, of hard work, of thrift, of working within your community. The problem is that that kind of language isn't there. And needs to be, because I'm convinced we will not turn this issue around until we find a way of not building bridges. We're not We're not building unity on this. We're ensuring that people across the political spectrum are pushing for change in the right direction. And then we can certainly have a big row about what we do about it. But this situation where large swathes of the right, not even a Tea Party, I mean, just completely middle ground conservatives are now not accepting the existence of a scientific fact, is very, very dangerous for us.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with communications expert George Marshall about his book, Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about property rights. Of course, so often property rights are used as a cudgel against environmental laws. But I went down to Washington, D.C. in the springtime to attend a climate march that was being held by a coalition of Native American groups and ranchers. And these ranchers, families that have been ranching for five generations, I'm sure many of them had been or were still Republicans, but they were up in arms because the Keystone XL pipeline was threatening their property rights. And they made common cause with Native Americans who also saw this as threatening their reservation property, the reservation rights. So it's already happened in the way that you're talking about it, and yet most people aren't drawing that lesson.
I think we need to amplify that because we need to show a much, much wider range of voices on this. My primary work now is in supporting and encouraging and amplifying the voice of people who are from very different politics from my own, because I want them to be seen and heard. It is very important that. I would like those ranchers to be seen and heard. And, you know, similarly, there's other people out there, and they're scattered and they're few and they're very, very brave because they're often taking on strong opposition within their own circles. But people in the faith movement, in the evangelical movement, amongst Republicans and conservatives who get climate change, and they're trying to shape it in forms that speak to their audiences. So I quote in the book is a guy called Rob Sissons who works with Conserve America, which is a conservative Catholic organization. And he says that climate change is the greatest threat to liberty since the threats to the unborn child. And he talks about how the poisons and the pollution from fossil fuels threatens babies in the womb. Language which I understand is not shared by many liberals. But in a way, that's not the point. The point is he's giving climate change a different shape that speaks to a different audience. But as well as all of this, as well as the fact that each different group should be taking shape of this in the same way, I think there are also a set of values that speak across all of us, a sense of a pride in terms of who we are, our shared humanity, our desire for the future. There are ways of building on that. And I think that's the role for great political leadership as well.
And you went to some mega churches and you found therein a lesson for climate activists. Talk about what you found in terms of the way megachurches speak to the positive emotional, you know, not just the fear or hell and damnation, as a lot of those of us on the left think of it, but also speak to positive values of community and connection. Give us some of the language that we need to use.
I had a number of interviews with evangelical leaders, people who are very conservative in their politics. People who had a proven track record in building their churches. And one of the key people I spoke to was a man called Joel Hunter, who led and founded, I think, what is now the 10th largest church in the U.S. He's one of Barack Obama's spiritual advisors, and his politics and faith are frankly conservative. And I said to Joel, I said, look, you can teach us so much in terms of how to build things up. And, you know, share with us, where do you think we're getting things wrong within the climate change movement? He said, well, one thing is that we try and build a real community of belief. We bring people together who share that belief, and then we really encourage it to share it with others outside through witnessing to say, this is important to me. And he said, you know, looking at what you guys do, you tend to just give people a leaflet and tell them to go to the website. And you don't encourage people to go out and really hold that and share it actively. And he said, we also encourage people to talk about their doubts and to share those doubts. And again, in climate change, I think it's considered anathema, you know, really taboo if you are in a climate change circle to say, you know what, I'm a bit doubtful about this, to be self-questioning. I think we're often so battered by the professional deniers that we're very wary of admitting the weakness of uncertainty or questioning ourselves. But that's a positive thing. We need to talk about that. We need to talk about our anxiety and our distress and our concern, our fears for the future quite openly, just as these guys in his church would. He also said it was very interesting that he came to a belief in climate change through a personal revelation, or he said like an epiphany. And I'm very interested in this. You know, most people who become passionate about climate change have some point of conversion, something where they go, yes, okay, I've seen enough, now I get it. I think we should be actively encouraging people to find that and to talk about it, because it is not just something that floats into your head from a pile of reports. It is something which you have to, which you come to accept over time. Within his church, for example, what he does is he puts people on that point. He says, okay, now you've seen and heard what I have to say. If you're prepared to change your life now, step forward. And I think that we need to be doing that much more actively too. I will say the final thing he points out, which I think is especially interesting, is that he said, well, we're giving people a heavy moral load. You know, we're saying to people that maybe what they've done before is wrong, they need to change the way they live, and there might be personal costs and sacrifices in that. And the reason we can do that is because we have a whole language of forgiveness. We allow the room for people to start fresh. And I have to say, it's very interesting, in climate change, we give a very, very heavy moral load of blame, of guilt, of responsibility, and there's no language of forgiveness. I think this is one of the great opportunities, is how can we think about forgiveness both for ourselves and what we've done, also for other people, also for people who have caused the problem, not to let them off the hook, not to say they don't have a responsibility, but to say there's a way of starting again. So I think, you know, I think there's so many different ways of talking about this. And don't get me wrong, I'm absolutely not for one second saying that climate change is or should be a religion. We're talking about whether or not there are lessons we can take from other places, including other political movements, including the labor movement, including social justice movements, but ways of organizing and mobilizing people around things that are difficult, where people are prone to denial, where they would like to avoid the truth, and are there techniques that we can apply for getting people passionate, making that crossover from what people know to what they feel?
I couldn't agree with you more, George Marshall, and I think your book, Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change, is a wonderful exploration of the direction we need to go in communication. I just want to thank you so much for writing this book. I recommend it highly to all our listeners. You know, get a copy and give a copy, because we need to turn this thing around.
And thank you so much for having me on your program. I really appreciate it. And again, to say for the people out there, of course, I'd be delighted if you buy the book. But I'm not a writer. I'm a change maker. And so what I really want you to do, please, is to share these ideas. I have a website, climateconviction.org, in which I'm going to be regularly posting up things, not just about the book, but also papers and information about how we can find new ways of shaping the language and the stories and the way we think about climate change. So please do become part of that, share the ideas, and let's see if we can reshape it.
And you can find a link to that site at writersvoice.net. You'll also find an excerpt from Marshall's book. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.